Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Joe Zimmel and Valerie Friedman.
This week on The Wheelhouse. The politics of reading, or rather the teaching of reading. We'll look at this debate in Connecticut and beyond. For Connecticut Public, I'm Frankie Graziano. This is The Wheelhouse, the show that connects politics to the people. We got your weekly dose of politics in Connecticut and beyond, right here. And if, like me, you grew up in the 90s, you might remember hearing this on your TV.
Learn to read with Hooked on Phonics, the musical reading program.
Hooked on Phonics works for me.
Call 1-800-ABCDEFG.
Is your child getting C's and D's when you know he or she is capable of A's and B's?
I wasn't getting good marks in reading.
It was painful for me as a parent to see Jessica struggling with reading.
Over the years, parents, grandparents, and teachers have reported Hooked on Phonics success stories. With intensive, systematic phonics, these children learned important skills used in reading.
The idea behind Hooked on Phonics, and phonics in general, is pretty simple. It's all about the relationship between letters and their corresponding sounds. Like if the word was dog, you'd sound out the word duh-og. Pretty straightforward, right? But what if I told you there's actually a lot of debate over how to teach children to read? In fact, there are two main schools of thought, passionate supporters behind each, so passionate that this debate's often called the reading wars. In one corner, you've got your phonics, part of the science of reading approach. And in that corner, you've got something called balanced literacy. And lately, it seems like the science of reading might be winning out. Right here in Connecticut, lawmakers passed a bill in 2021 to implement reading curricula based on the science of reading. As of this broadcast, more than half of the 201 districts and charter schools in Connecticut report piloting, researching, or adopting from the list of the state's approved reading curricula. That's according to the State Department of Education. So how did reading, or rather the teaching of reading, become so political?
And to break down all this, we're joined by three great guests. Very lucky to have on Emily Hanford today, senior producer and correspondent at American Public Media. She also hosted the award-winning podcast, Sold a Story. Good morning, Emily.
Hi. Glad to be here.
Thank you for coming on, Emily. Louise Spear-Swirling also joins us, professor emerita in the Department of Special Education at Southern Connecticut State University. Good morning, Louise. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you. It's great to be here.
And finally, joined by Dr. Margie Gillis, founder and president of Connecticut-based nonprofit Literacy How. Good morning, Dr. Gillis.
Good morning to you, and thanks for inviting me.
Before we get into the politics of reading, I kind of want to go back in time a little. Do you all remember how you were taught to read? What's your memory of that? I don't know who wants to go first. Maybe Dr. Gillis can go first on how you were taught to read.
Oh, I definitely remember it well. I was taught to read with Dick and Jane. Good old Dick and Jane, sight word kind of approach to learning to read. However, I went to Catholic schools and the nuns did not throw the baby out with the bathwater and continued to teach us using some phonics.
I learned to read in a way similar to Margie, minus the Catholic school part. But I did learn with Dick and Jane, and I do remember getting some phonics in school. But I think also I was lucky that that part of reading came easily to me.
I certainly remember Dick and Jane. I did not get Dick and Jane in school. I don't actually remember very much about learning to read, and I don't remember much about being taught. I think like Louise, I was one of those kids who learned pretty easily. I don't think I needed much instruction. I think there are enough kids, especially in some schools, who don't need a whole lot of instruction, and they really, a lot of being in a literate environment and being on a caregiver's lap who reads books to them and a little bit of instruction to, in school kind of gets them going, and they kind of get going with reading, and they end up really teaching themselves quite a bit about written language and how it works. But the big aha, one of the many big ahas that I had as a reporter, is that that is not something I had ever thought about. I think because learning to read came easily to me, and it came pretty easily to my two kids, it never really occurred to me to think much about reading instruction. But it turns out that a lot of people, including a lot of very, very smart people, have a hard time learning how to read. And unless someone really teaches them well at that early stage when they first get to school, many of them struggle for a lot of their lives. And it is actually a secret and a source of shame for some people that they carry around with them, that they never really learned how to be a good reader. But good reading instruction at an early age can really help almost everyone learn how to read.
We're looking at a little bit of a literacy crisis in the U.S. right now, and Emily kind of hinted at it there. How did we get here, Margie?
Honestly, I mean, I think it's complex, and certainly Emily has enlightened many people about the complexity of the issue. So it's not one thing. Mm-hmm. I think part of it is that balanced literacy, whole language, is more appealing. It feels more like more fun. Immerse children in language, encourage them to be good readers and writers, incentivize them by reading interesting books, and, you know, voila, kids are going to learn to read. And we know that's not the case. So I think that's part of it. I also think that we haven't given teachers enough support.
Margie, can you help me specifically with childhood literacy? And let's go to Connecticut more specifically and talk about how childhood literacy is in Connecticut.
There is a tremendous amount of variability in our state. I would say that. And there are, you know, Connecticut is known for having one of the largest achievement gaps in the country. I think that is still true today. If you look at the NAEP data and you disaggregate it by subgroup, Connecticut is doing pretty poorly compared to our peers like Massachusetts that have at an aggregate level about the same level of performance on the National Assessment of Educational Progress, the nation's report card. But if you look at the subgroups, we're not doing well at all. And so that variability exists. We have two Connecticuts. We have Bridgeport, New Haven, Waterbury, Hartford, and then we have Fairfield County and parts of Hartford County that are more affluent. Even in those affluent towns, I will tell you that there are many children who don't learn to read, despite the fact that they have parents of means and parents that can get them tutors and whatnot. Many of those families are told their children are doing just fine. Emily reported on that beautifully with a couple of her podcasts prior to this Sold a Story.
And this is kind of where I want to go with you, Emily. In Connecticut and across the U.S., a big push for the science of reading in our classrooms to close this literacy gap. What exactly is the science of reading? What does that mean?
That's a great question. I'm glad you asked. I see that term being thrown around a lot these days, and I see it being sort of misused and misunderstood. And it's not a curriculum. It's not an approach. It's not a way to teach. You don't do the science of reading. The science of reading is a body of scientific research, a big, huge body of scientific research that has been done over the last 50 plus years, actually. And I'll just go back a little bit to the beginning, because I think we threw around a few terms here, like Dick and Jane and sight words, and phonics was mentioned once. And I would love to just tell you a teeny bit about the history, which answers the question of sort of what the science of reading is. So we really have been arguing for a long time in this country, and not just in this country, about how to teach kids to read. You can see it going back to the beginning of public education. And I think we fought for good reason, because no one really knew. We didn't know how people read. We didn't really know how kids learn to read. We had some ideas, some better ideas better than others, but we didn't really have a lot of answers. Just reading. How do our brains do it? How do we even do that? And a lot of scientists, cognitive scientists, psychologists, linguists, lots of different scientists in labs and in classrooms all over the world in lots of different languages got really interested in that question, that series of questions about reading and how it works. Back in the 1960s, 70s, 80s, by the 90s, they had figured out a huge amount about reading and how it works. That's the science of reading, this big, huge body of research that answered these questions that had actually sort of vexed us as human beings. How do we read? How do we do that? Well, they answered a whole lot of questions that have implications for teaching. And the problem is that just teachers haven't gotten this knowledge. Many of them weren't aware of that research, or maybe they were aware of it, that they weren't really exactly sure what it said. They understood that there was fights about it, battles, that it was contentious. They didn't really understand the implications for teaching. And that's really what my reporting over the past 6 years has focused on, trying to help people, trying to translate some of this stuff so that it's easier for teachers and for parents and school administrators and members of the general public to understand that there is this big body of research that has implications for teaching, and that we're not doing a good enough job in a lot of places actually translating that into practice. And getting back to a couple of things that were said about the dynamics in Connecticut, for example, one of the things that I have found in my reporting for years now is that I will talk to parents in some of the quote unquote best school districts in the country. Some parents in Connecticut were among them. And their kids, these are mostly relatively affluent families, and their kids go to really good public schools and they do everything right. There's tons of books in the home and they read to their kids, and then their kids aren't learning to read in school. And the parents know it. And often they're told by the school, it's fine. Don't worry. He's doing okay. He'll catch up. Don't worry. She'll be fine. And then they're not fine. And what happens is some of the kids in this country have a backup plan, and the backup plan is their parents and their parents' checkbook, because those parents then go seek out tutoring, seek out specialized services. And often it's really late and their kids have really suffered and the kids are already behind, but they have the money. They come up with the money that it takes to get the kind of instruction that their kids need. So many kids aren't getting that, though. And we can't have a system where we're leaving it up to the parents and the resources that parents have in terms of money and time. We really need to make sure that all kids get the instruction they need so they all have a chance to become good readers.
The blue bloods have trouble reading as well. I want to help you.
Yes, many of them do.
That's right. And I want you to help me clarify something. If a school district isn't using an approach based on the science of reading, what are they using?
When I've talked to teachers, when I've gone into classrooms, what you'll often find is that it's a mix of the stuff they inherited from the teacher who used to be in that classroom, what they learned at this professional development, a little bit of something they learned in their teacher training program, and a little bit of the curriculum that the school district maybe or maybe not provides. And so it really varies a lot teacher to teacher, which is why my reporting, I realized that I really needed to better understand what is it that teachers have in their minds about reading and how it works, because that's telling you something about what they think they need to do. If they're closing their door and really doing the best that they know how, what do they know? What is the idea that they have about knowing how? And it's gone back to the fact that I think many of us, many people, until they encounter something otherwise, really sort of presume that learning to read is a lot like learning to talk. That if you read a lot to kids and you give them books and you show them books, that they'll learn how to read, which is really the way that we talk. Well, we learn to talk through interacting with people, people talking to us, us talking to them. But one of the big findings, one of the big ahas of all this science of reading is that learning to read is not like learning to talk. That it really does require at the beginning stages for all of us some instruction, and some of us need a lot more instruction than others. So I'll go to Louise to say, so if they're not following the science of reading, if they're not teaching in a way that lines up with the science of reading, what are they doing in Connecticut?
Well, so thank you for that. One of the things I'd like to kind of piggyback on what both Margie and Emily have said is that for the teachers, keep in mind that most teachers have little or no input to the curriculum that's being used in their school. They're not the ones that are picking the curriculum. An administrator is picking the curriculum. And some curricula that are used really make it hard to teach according to what science tells us, science of reading, you know, reading intervention research or reading instruction research. For example, one of the most common findings in all of reading instruction research is that children benefit from explicit teaching. Explicit teaching means the teacher directly explains, models, does examples. Now, children do have to make some inferences, and some children don't have a lot of difficulty making those inferences, as we've talked about. But if the school uses a curriculum that's sort of, say, a workshop model, where every student is reading in a different book or working on a different project, it sounds kind of good. It's very child-centered, but it's very difficult in that kind of curriculum for teachers to do significant amounts of explicit teaching. So I think that, you know, lack of explicit instruction is one of the big issues. And I have known teachers who have told me that they've gone to professional development workshops where they have actually been told explicit teaching is bad. You should, you know, foster inquiry and be a guide, and the children should make their own inferences. And that, so the teachers are often being, you know, sort of handcuffed by some of the things that are happening in schools that are not under their control. And then the other big piece of it is not having the preparation to teach important reading skills explicitly and systematically. And with regard to basic phonics, learning basic phonics is not, especially for children who are at risk, teaching it and learning it is not highly intuitive. It's not enough for the teacher to be a good reader himself or herself. They have to understand certain, you know, they have to understand the structure of language in order to be able to teach it effectively. And many teachers are not getting that kind of preparation. And then they go into a school that expects them maybe to whip up their own phonics program, which is a completely unreasonable expectation for really for any teacher, but particularly for a gen ed teacher who's trying to meet the needs of, you know, 20, 25 students in a class.
We had heard throughout the beginning portion of the show a little bit about Dick and Jane books. Can only do this briefly if possible, but that other approach, from my understanding, is something called balanced literacy. I know it's evolved a little bit, but Emily Hanford, could you just help me out a little bit with what a Dick and Jane book is and balanced literacy? And if you could do it quickly, I'd appreciate it.
Sure. So Dick and Jane is basically this sight word method. And the idea was sort of a theory about reading and how it works, that we basically memorize words, that you associate words with pictures, and that's how kids become readers. That was one idea. Then phonics was this idea that came in, which is a little bit different. Instead of having kids look at pictures and look at whole words, you teach them the little parts. And so there was a big bang out fight about this, and it became between whole language, which is slightly different than whole word, and phonics. And that was really the reading wars of the 1980s and 90s. And we really sort of supposedly settled those wars. A lot of people thought those wars ended in the early 2000s with this thing called balanced literacy, which sounds great. Balance is actually exactly what you want in early reading instruction. The problem is that balanced literacy really is the same sort of theory of whole language, whole word, the idea that kids don't have to be taught how to read the written words. And what happened in balanced literacy is they added a little bit of phonics instruction, sort of a little bit here and there, kind of like salt on a meal is one of the ways that I referred to it in some of the reporting that I did, but really not enough of it in many cases, or not done well. As Louise was talking about, the teachers themselves don't know enough about written language to teach it well. And the really key idea that I explore in Sold a Story is just adding some phonics instruction isn't enough. You have to take away this other idea, which is that kids can be taught these other strategies for learning to read the words. They can be taught these things like, look at the picture, look at the first letter, memorize the word, think of something that makes sense. This is what is happening in balanced literacy. Kids are being taught all these different strategies for figuring out the words. And the problem is that many kids sort of pick up the bad habit of using those other strategies and not doing the thing that actually helps us get those words into our memory, which is looking carefully at the words and sounding them out. And that is the process that helps you as a good reader eventually get thousands and thousands of words into your long-term memory, so that when you're reading, the words aren't an issue. You know the words in an instant. And what's happening is your brain is focusing on the meaning of what you're reading, which is the goal. That's what we're all trying to do when we read. But too many kids aren't being taught well enough how to read the words, and that's getting in their way, and it stays in their way for a lot of their life.
Generally speaking here, Margie, how has this been received in our state, the science of reading, especially by school districts and leaders? I'm wondering from their perspective.
It really does vary, not only from district to district, but within districts. You have some district leaders who are all about it and really are paying attention to the research and really letting and allowing that research to guide their decisions, which is fantastic. And then you have people who are holding on to balanced literacy and workshop because they truly believe it's the best thing for kids. And when that happens, as you can imagine, there's a lot of confusion, no alignment from within the district, from school to school, even classroom to classroom. And something that I want to just piggyback on that Emily talked about, in many schools, we still have classrooms where balanced literacy is really the way that teachers are teaching kids. But then they might have the phonics patch that Emily called salt on the meal. I also love the phonics patch idea, where they have a program and the kids may go to a different teacher for that program, or could be the same teacher, learning how to sound out the words, practicing decoding and spelling, et cetera. And then they read their level text where they're guessing words using the three cueing strategies. So the children who are most vulnerable are the kids that are easily confused. One teacher is telling that child one thing, another child teacher is telling them something different, and they don't know who to believe, and it's just completely confusing, and they throw up their hands. I hear about this all the time, and I see it. I can't do this. I don't understand it. English is not an easy language to learn to read and write for many children, but you add confusion on the part of the teacher, it transfers directly to those children. And that lack of alignment is driving a lot of that, actually.
From Connecticut Public Radio, this is The Wheelhouse. I'm Frankie Graziano. More on the politics of reading in just a minute.
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford HealthCare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford HealthCare. The FDA has recently approved Zepbound, a new medication for chronic weight management. Dr. Davida Umashankar, Hartford HealthCare's System Medical Director of Medical Weight Loss, tells us more.
Zepbound helps decrease hunger and increase satiety levels. Taking this medication for 72 weeks, people can see at the highest dosage approximately 48 pounds of weight loss. So definitely a powerful drug and another powerful tool that we have to utilize to help individuals who struggle with obesity.
For those ready to explore their medical weight loss options, Dr. Umashankar has advice on the first most important step.
I don't think anyone knows you better than your own primary care physician. So having that conversation whenever you feel ready is so important, because these medications are quite powerful and do need to be monitored on a regular basis.
To learn more, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
This is The Wheelhouse from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Frankie Graziano. All hour, we're talking about the so-called reading wars and the push for the science of reading in Connecticut and beyond. Still with me are Emily Hanford. She's a senior producer and correspondent at American Public Media. She also hosted the award-winning podcast, Sold a Story, How Teaching Kids to Read Went So Wrong. Luis Spear Swirling, also joining us via Zoom, Professor Emerita in the Department of Special Education at Southern Connecticut State University. And also joining us on Zoom, Dr. Margie Gillis, founder and president of the Connecticut-based nonprofit Literacy How. Emily, the debate over reading instruction is referred to as the reading wars. How far back does this debate go, and when and why do you think this emerged?
I think it emerged because no one knew how people learned to read, and there just wasn't there. We just didn't have answers. And then I think we really have found a lot of answers over the past 50 years. There have been new techniques, new kinds of research, huge studies. Louise talked about this before, these huge intervention studies where they actually, so it's sort of like two different kinds of studies. There's sort of this brain research where we've been able to really glimpse inside people's brain. What does your brain look like before you know how to read or when you're struggling to read? It turns out that when you learn to read, when you become a good reader, your brain actually looks a little different. We are not actually born with brains that were sort of designed to read, because as human beings, we just started reading a few thousand years ago and we've been talking to each other for a really long time. But this reading and writing thing is relatively new. And it's really new over the past few hundred years that we really need everybody to know how to do it. For a long time, not that many people really needed to know how to read and write. So the brain research has given us a lot of insight, but really these big, huge, real world studies where they've tried things in classrooms, they've tried different approaches, they've tried interventions to try to figure out what helps kids. When kids are struggling, what do you need to do to help them learn how to become good readers? And there's just been a huge, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars has been invested in that research over the past 40 years. And really, we shouldn't be arguing about this anymore. Now, the problem here is that there just are a lot of people who have ideas and beliefs that I think they're holding fast to, just because in many cases they haven't known that there's something else. They haven't been aware that there's all this research out there. And what I hear from teachers all the time, pretty much every day, is, I didn't know this. Why didn't I know it? And now I'm starting to learn it. And this is huge. The implications for teaching are huge. As I'm just learning some basic things about reading and how it works, I'm seeing that I haven't been doing enough of X, that over here, this hasn't been working. That in fact, when I am teaching kids these cueing strategies to try to figure out the words, I am actually teaching them the habits of struggling readers. This was the really big aha for me, is that all over the country, teachers think they're teaching kids strategies that will be helpful to them. And in fact, they're teaching them to do the very thing that it turns out, when you are a person who was never taught to read and it's really hard for you, you do a lot of things like memorize as many words as you can. Look at the first letter of a word, look at the pictures, try to think of something that makes sense, skip a lot of words. That is exactly what it's like when you're a struggling reader. And those are the strategies that little kids are being taught in school.
And getting here, do you think that, just really quickly, I'm hoping to kind of crystallize this. Do you think that urgency around kind of realizing that maybe we were teaching kids, we actually were teaching kids the habits of struggling readers to try to get them to read well, if that makes sense. Do you think that that kind of created urgency in this debate?
Absolutely. I mean, I think there is a lot of urgency, and you can just look to, there's been a lot of legislation that's been passed over the past few years. There really has been a movement that I think was really started by parents of kids of struggling readers who, like I said before, were doing sort of all the quote unquote right things and their kids still couldn't read. So we've really had a movement that's been motivated by parents over the last 10 years. And that movement has been built upon the fact that there is this research and that we know all this about reading and how it works. And then I think journalism, mine and others, there are now a lot of journalists who are getting interested in this topic. I think the more and more people know about this, understand that this is a real problem, I think there really is a lot of urgency. And since the Sold a Story podcast came out in October, there's been sort of a new wave of legislation. At least 20 states have come up with some kind of new effort to try to change and improve reading instruction in their states. I don't know if all of these efforts are good. Like, it would be better if we could change this without having to pass laws. But laws are being passed because I think a lot of legislators are getting the message like there's really a problem and it needs attention from above. And so there are really some big policy efforts. But there are lots of ways that policy can have unintended consequences and that policy gets resisted. And at the end of the day, as I think we've already heard in this interview, it's about what the teacher does in his or her classroom all day. And Laws and policies only go so far.
We're talking about the laws of the land here, Margie, rather than the teaching of reading. How did reading become so political?
Well, the wars, as Emily said, have been around for a long time. So it has been a political debate on some level. And I think in one of your podcasts, Emily, you talked about that. I don't believe it should be by any means. I mean, who would argue that every child should learn to read and it should not be a partisan issue? When the National Reading Panel report came out and the Bush administration's desire to put a federal law in place to require that the science be taught, it wasn't called the science of reading at the time. It was referred to as, I think, scientifically based reading research, but it still stood for this body of research that Emily is talking about. But, you know, people look at research in different ways. And in the scientific research that I think Louise and Emily and I respect, it's really a lot of it is quantitative research, gold standard, randomized controlled trials, if possible, to determine what works best, just like we do in medical research. And people that subscribe to balanced literacy tend to have a greater respect for qualitative research and believe that there is a body of research that supports the use of balanced literacy. Again, that's a divide that I wish didn't exist, because meanwhile, this reading war is continuing to be waged and we have many children left on the battlefield, really. And that's what upsets me, and I'm sure our listeners and certainly my colleagues here the most.
That was very powerful, Margie. I appreciate that. And just to move back into kind of politics, Republican President George W. Bush had a Reading First initiative. Can you briefly remind us of what that entailed?
Sure. Reading First was part of the No Child Left Behind law, which many people know and became very controversial, and there are many, very many parts of it that a lot of people didn't like. The Reading First was a big chunk of money that was really trying to incentivize schools to follow what was then called scientifically backed reading research. And there was really a big effort around it in the early 2000s. And there was a variety of results. There were some places that had some really big success with it and other places not so much. There was some research about it. There are some questions about the research and how it was done. So it was all very big and complicated, like any multi-billion dollar effort from the federal government can be. And it got very politicized, and there was a decent amount of pushback, as I think there always is. And I think in many places, and we could be replicating this problem right now, it's very important to learn from what happened during Reading First. I think in many places, teachers were just sort of handed a new textbook or handed a new curriculum and told, now you're doing this. And they didn't understand why, and they didn't understand how to do it. It's really, really important that this time we really get it right consistently and more deeply. And I think that's the work that people like Margie and Louise are doing. And there are a lot of people doing that in many states to really help teachers understand the why and the how of why they need to change some things about how they teach reading. So the Reading First initiative really basically had fallen apart. So it lasted about, depending on who you're counting, 5 to 7 years or so. And I think it really paved the way for balanced literacy. It really brought in this idea, like a lot of people were willing to say like, okay, no, phonics is okay. We're okay with some phonics instruction. We can bring in a little bit of phonics instruction. And they started adding that in and sort of thinking, oh, well, we're doing everything that the research says. But what they didn't get rid of is this idea that's at the core of balanced literacy and that was at the core of whole language, which is people don't need to sound out the words. That's not necessary. You also have all these other ways you can figure out the words. And that really is a problem, because to get to the science, just to get nerdy for 1 second, the way you get all those words into your brain so that you don't have to deal with them and think about them, it's like a reflex, your ability to read the words, is by carefully sounding them out and connecting the pronunciation of word with its spelling and its meaning. And when those three things get like glued together in your mind, you've got that word. So a lot of the words that you can read, Frankie, and that our listeners can read really quickly and easily, you can read them because maybe when you were 6 years old, you laboriously sounded out that word letter by letter and finally figured out, oh yeah. Like there's an example of a kid in Sold a Story who's doing smiling. And that is a moment when the kid got the word. He knows the word. He knows what it means. He doesn't know how to read it. He just connected those letters with that pronunciation and that meaning. And he's like, I got it. And what the research tells us is that kid needs to see that word a few more times and he's got it. And forever now, that word smiling, you can't take that away from him. Unless he gets like a brain injury, he will forever know that word in an instant. And we need to make sure that kids are getting the kind of instruction that enables that early on.
Delightful. And I believe we actually heard smiling phonetically said multiple times in Sold a Story. I believe the kids at Booker Elementary on a tough day in American history on September 11th, 2001, they also sound out the word smiling in a similar
form. I love that you caught that because that was such a beautiful little mirror there that we were able to put into the podcast.
Well, if you do a good podcast and you have me listen to it, I think I could remember those details pretty well. So thank you so much for that, Emily. Just want to feature some commentary for you, Emily, from former advisor to President Bush, Karl Rove.
And what we know from research is phonics works. Not some fancy program of psychological babble.
Has either of the main approaches to reading been associated historically with the left or right? Phonics, was it a Republican talking point at the time?
Yes, and I think that's part of what's happened. I mean, I think these things, for a long time, there are long roots of the idea of phonics as sort of basics, back to basics, traditional direct instruction, kids sitting in rows. That was sort of one image. And then the more whole language balanced literacy was more learning by doing, kids discovering, kids figuring things out for themselves, right? And it really is, ultimately, good education is some combination of those. What we're talking about is sort of is like, how does a little kid get to being a good reader? What are the steps that it takes to get there? And that's where I think a lot of the reading instruction has sort of gone awry. But it's really important here to note that this is not just about phonics, because what we've said a couple of times is adding some phonics doesn't solve this problem. Number one, because you've got to take away this other idea. But number two, because phonics is not all that you need to do. I said that the way you get a word into your mind is by connecting the pronunciation, the spelling, and the meaning. You got to have all those things. If you are a kid who does not know the meaning of a lot of words, who does not have a lot of language knowledge, learning to read is actually going to be difficult to you. And a very big responsibility of school is to increase kids' vocabulary and their knowledge so that they, when they know how to decode those words and read those words, they know what they mean. Because those words will not get into their brain if they don't know the meaning of them. So there are a lot of pieces to this. It's really wrong for people to take away this idea that this whole conversation about the science of reading is just about phonics instruction. It is not.
From Connecticut Public Radio, this is The Wheelhouse. I'm Frankie Graziano. More on the politics of reading in just a minute.
You're listening to the new investigative reporting podcast, In Absentia, which means you're interested in getting to the facts and uncovering the truth. If you'd like to help us continue our investigative work, consider making a donation. Visit ctpublic.org/tapsupport and contribute today. That's ctpublic.org/tapsupport. Thank you for being a part of the Accountability Project.
If you've never donated to this station before, that's okay. Public Radio is available to everyone for free. But we do rely on listener support from those who are able to give. So join the community of supporters for Public Media Giving Days. And thanks.
Give now at ctpublic.org/donate.
This is The Wheelhouse from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Frankie Graziano. And if you're just joining us, we're going big on the politics of reading today. As our guests have been explaining to you, there's long been sometimes intense debate over how to teach kids to read. And that debate has often been politicized. Here with me, via Zoom, Emily Hanford, senior producer and correspondent at American Public Media. Also, Louise Spear-Swirling, professor emerita in the Department of Special Education at Southern Connecticut State University. And Dr. Margie Gillis, founder and president of the Connecticut-based nonprofit Literacy How. Louise, as we've been talking about this debate over reading instruction, often called the reading wars, how does that language further divide the reading instruction community?
Well, I think the language honestly just captures what's already there. Often when I talk to teacher candidates, if I ask them, have you heard of the reading wars, I get some blank stares. So the teachers are not always familiar with that language, but they know all too well the disagreements about how reading should be taught. So they're definitely very sensitive to that.
I know it's not fun always to talk about the politics of something, but we get into it because there are consequences, I believe. So what do you think, Margie?
Yeah, there are definitely are consequences. And again, it's the children who pay for those politics. At the end of the day, it should never be about the politics. It should never be about the egos. And oftentimes that's what it's about. It should always be about what's best for children. And if you are a teacher on the front lines doing their work every day, they will tell you, they know when they're doing a good job and when they're struggling. They oftentimes are told what to say to parents. When in their heart, they would respond differently, but they're worried about their jobs. And I feel for teachers. I really, really feel for teachers. And I'm worried about the teaching profession because many good teachers are leaving our profession because they're not appreciated, they're not supported, they're not given the tools. As Louise mentioned, they have no autonomy when it comes to deciding what to do for children. And we're asking them to do the impossible really right now. So I do everything I can in the work that I do with teachers to support them. I will put in one big plug, and that is to say administrators need to learn the science of reading. If administrators don't understand what this is all about and start to study it and understand it, we're not going to go very far. Because at the end of the day, they are the decision makers, whether it's the principal in the school or the curriculum director who's purchasing the next program for the student, for the staff, or at the very top, the superintendent. I think it's extremely important that we bring them to the table along with Board of Ed members, too.
Emily, we were talking a little bit about teachers there, but I want to think about all the pressure that students face now, because you have all of this body of research, as you talked about, from essentially the 70s, 80s, 90s to today. And there's been an effort to sort of go against that over the last 30 years by some of the folks that you chronicle in your podcast. Then, especially if we're talking about getting some of those cueing strategies in there or balanced literacy approaches in there, I could see children kind of getting lost, and I can see how complicated it can be to read. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think that came up before that kids are confused often because this is actually difficult to learn, and they'll often get one message in from one teacher and one from another, or literally one message in one part of their reading instruction and another message in another part. They might be given a phonics lesson in one part, and then they go off to their guided reading groups and they're given these books and they haven't actually been taught how to read those words. So the only way they can read those books is to use those other strategies. Like, well, look at the picture. Think of something that makes sense. So they're getting two different messages about what they're supposed to be doing and about what reading is. But I would like to, I do think it's actually really important to think about the student experience here. So I think one of the things that is really clear to many kids when they go to school is they know that their main task when they're 5, 6, 7 years old and they're starting school is to learn how to be in school and to learn how to read. And many of them start having a difficult time with it right away. And often it's their little secret. They don't really want anyone to know. They don't want their teacher to know. They do anything they can to hide it. They don't even want their mom or their dad or their caregiver to know. As one teacher said, who's a mom who has a struggling reader and discovered all the things that were wrong about the way she was teaching reading when her own child wasn't able to read and she couldn't teach her. What she said about her child is the kids know first, the parents know second, then maybe the teacher chimes in, and then the hunt is on for help. So many, many kids are really holding this, and then the parents and others are sort of discovering it along the way. And then they get older and older, and you start to fall behind in other subjects. You start to really not like school because you're always being asked to do this reading thing, and this reading thing is frustrating and hard and confusing. And this turns into a kid who's in upper elementary and middle school and is becoming disengaged, perhaps having behavior problems because they're trying to distract attention away from the fact that they can't read. They might come sort of depressed, inward, shy, the quiet one. You know, in a lot of classes, it's that little quiet one who's really struggling, and maybe that loud one who is getting all the attention to himself or herself, or try and get kicked out of class when it's time to do reading, when it's time to do reading, read out loud. I have said to many people that my years of reporting have revealed to me that if you want to find the kids who are struggling the most with reading in school, go to the nurse's office and find the kids who have tummy aches during the literacy block, because that's often where they're going to get out of having to do that.
I appreciate that image you just painted in my head of the child facing a lot of pressure to tell somebody at some point, hey, I'm not getting this. And I also appreciated it while I listened to the podcast. You shared several anecdotes where it comes out that the child eventually goes to mom or dad and says, hey, I can't do this. I can't read right now. So I really do appreciate that. Moving a little away from the students here and talking about the teachers, Margie, what advice do you have for the teachers out there? And first, give me some advice for teachers. And then secondarily, could you give me some advice for parents, Margie?
For teachers, I would say, you have to be willing to advocate for yourself with your administrators and ask for the support that you need, because if you don't, they're not going to give it to you necessarily. It's hard to find that time in the day, but if you and your colleagues and do find the people that have the same feelings that you do and really want good professional development and want to do the right thing by children, I think, you know, there's power in numbers. So go to your administrator at the district level too and ask for what you need and let them know that that's very, very important to you. For parents, I would say trust your gut. Parents know when something is wrong with their child. And if you believe there's a problem and you talk to your to the school and the school says, no, everything is fine, but you still have that gut feeling that something is wrong, then pursue it. Don't let it go, because parents will be told it's okay. And then they feel good, like, oh, I guess I was just feeling something that wasn't there. And you waited precious time. You don't want to wait a minute, because every minute counts in this. If you don't learn to read in first grade, you have a very low chance of catching up, right? You can learn to read, but the curriculum continues in second and third and fourth, and you're not taught to read in fourth grade. You're taught to read in kindergarten and first grade. If you miss that opportunity, you've missed something very important. Again, it can happen. It's just harder. So trust your gut, parents.
We're going to close the show with Louise. I want to know, where do you see this going? Where do you see the debate over reading instruction heading in the future, Louise?
Well, I think it's very encouraging that there's so much interest in the topic, so much public interest. I think Emily's work is a huge, you know, impetus behind that, because she took these concepts like multiple queuing systems and explain them in a way that is understandable to a general audience and kind of made clearer to a general audience, including teachers, why it's problematic to teach that way. And so that part of it is very encouraging to me. You know, you asked before about, I think it was to Margie, about her advice to teachers. And I certainly agree with everything she said. Another thing I would add on to that is there are some great resources now available to teachers. I think when Margie and I both started our careers, there was not nearly so much available that was written for practitioners translating the science into practical applications. So for example, the Institute for Education Sciences Practice Guides, teachers can just Google IES Practice Guides. Those are great resources that distill the research on how to teach different areas, including reading. There are some great, you know, books by people that are really well known, like Louisa Moats and many people that can serve as great resources for teachers. And there are online communities that teachers can connect with people that are like-minded. So I would encourage people to also, you know, kind of pursue that in their own professional development.
Terrific show today. Huge thanks to Emily Hanford, Louise Spear-Swirling, and Dr. Margie Gillis for spending the hour with us. Massive thanks to you all. And we're going to link to Emily's podcast if you go to ctpublic.org/thewheelhouse. The podcast is Soul the Story. Check it out there. Today's show was produced by Meg Dalton. Our technical producers are Katie Tolarski and Kat Pastor. Download The Wheelhouse anytime on your favorite podcast app. I'm Frankie Graziano. This is The Wheelhouse. Thank you for listening.